guys will wait. Good evening.
Good evening.
All right, we continue our study tonight from lessons from the Holy Lands. We're going to pick up and look at, as I mentioned this morning, we're going to look at a couple of places that young folks that have been participating in Bible Bowl and those not so young that have been participating in Bible Bowl, some places that you may have seen in not this week's that we did, but last week in chapters 11 and 12, a couple of places that were mentioned there. So one thing I want to say before we start off is last time, which I think was 2 weeks ago, we spent the whole time talking about Caesarea Maritima with a little bit of Valley of Jezreel in the end. But Caesarea Maritima is 2,000 years old. And a couple of you commented, like, it's amazing how intact it is. The things that we're going to look at tonight are much older. Some cases, 5,000 plus years older. Not older, but 5,000 plus years old. And they're not quite as intact because of the age. The two big places we're going to look at tonight, we'll look at a third, but the two big places we're going to look at tonight were the site of many conflicts. And so there were places that were destroyed, rebuilt, destroyed, rebuilt, destroyed, rebuilt. So much of what has been found in rubble because it's underneath the ground and it was, you know, from past destruction. So for those of you that are watching online or watch this later, I do want to let you know that there is a copy of the slides, and if you're on Facebook, go grab those off of Facebook, because I know it's going to be hard to see through the video, but grab those, they are available. I did want to mention, in case there's anyone interested, I'm already thinking about the next trip. And so if you are interested in learning information about that trip and any future trip that I decide to host, there is a mailing list that I have put together. So if you'd like to sign up for that mailing list just to get information, this is not a commitment to anything, but just, hey, if I send out information about a trip that I'm working on, you'll be the first ones to know. So if you want to go to that site, there's a form to fill out. If you want to join that mailing list, again, not a commitment to anything, but where I'm working on right now is thinking about spring, summer 24. I started looking at next year, but everything I was going to look at next year was I was going to miss something from Kate's senior year of high school, so I said not doing that, so probably looking at spring, summer 24 if anyone is interested. All right, first place I want to talk about is Megiddo. All right, now who remembers, it's only been a week, but who remembers Megiddo being mentioned in Joshua chapter 12? Mike does. Anybody else remember Megiddo? This is a very brief reference. In chapter 12, you know, in chapter 12 where it's got, and the king of such and such won, and the king of, well, Megiddo is mentioned in that list, okay? And so hopefully you remember that from Joshua chapter 12. It's mentioned again in Joshua 17. But Megiddo, so last week we talked about Caesarea, or 2 weeks ago, Caesarea Maritima, which is over here on the coast, kind of cut off, but just to the south of Mount Carmel down here. And then we also, 2 weeks ago, talked about the Valley of Jezreel, most notably where you have the story of Deborah and Barak, you have where Gideon selected his army, or, you know, God giving him instructions on how to select his army. Those things happen in the Valley of Jezreel. Well, Megiddo is on kind of the southwest side of the Valley of Jezreel, kind of in the foothills of Mount Carmel. And Megiddo dates all the way back. There are references back to Megiddo all the way back to 5,000 BC. Okay, so again, 5,000 BC, it means this is 7,000, you know, there's references back 7,000 years to Megiddo. And Megiddo was an important city because it was located, and I have this on there, located on the Via Maris. That was a trade route, a route that connected, got this up here, Egypt, with several significant northern empires, Syria, Mesopotamia. And so this was considered a very important city because it was along this very important trade route. And so much so that Pharaoh Thutmose III said capturing of Megiddo is the capturing of 1,000 cities. This was a very strategically important city, okay? Because of that, where have I got that? Somewhere in here. I'll get to it. Yeah, so because of that, Megiddo was destroyed at least 30 times. Now, remember the discussion, we'll talk about this more in a minute. Remember the discussion we've had both in the introduction and 2 weeks ago about the concept of a tell, the artificial hill that is built of, you know, civilizations destroyed, new civilizations built. Well, that means that what we have in Megiddo today is we have 30 strata that make up the tell, 30 layers, each one representing a different age in history. So this is one of the largest tells from a number of strata standpoint that exist in the country of Israel. Again, changed hands a lot of times. Now, going back here, Megiddo is mentioned 12 times in the Old Testament. We just talked about the first reference to Megiddo, which comes in Joshua 12, as one of those cities that was conquered by the children of Israel, listed among the 31 kings that were conquered in Joshua 12. It's mentioned again in Joshua 17. Apparently, all the Canaanites were not gone from Megiddo because it is listed as one of those cities where there still needs to be some, and these are my words, but some cleanup done to push the Canaanites out. But Megiddo is known for some other things as well. After the time of Joshua, which again, Joshua is largely about the conquest of Israel, but after the time of Joshua, Megiddo is mentioned in the time of Solomon. And Solomon, in his reign, he built up the strength of the nation of Israel. And it mentions in the book of 1 Kings that some specific cities that Solomon built up, he strengthened cities. And Megiddo was one of those cities that Solomon fortified, strengthened. And so there are things within the ruins of Megiddo that date back to the, you know, roughly the time of Solomon. So there are, again, Solomon is significant to the story of Megiddo. Another reason why it is known from Scripture is that this is the place where King Josiah died. Now, this is much later, much after the time of Solomon. But 609 B.C., died at the hands of Pharaoh Necho. You can read about that in 2 Kings 23, where King Josiah died at Megiddo. Now, I mentioned about Megiddo 30 times being destroyed, but one thing I haven't mentioned yet is that in Revelation 16, there is this word picture of this final battle that takes place, okay? And in the midst of that discussion, it says that it will take place at Armageddon, and we refer to that battle sometimes as the Battle of Armageddon. The name Armageddon comes from Megiddo, okay? And so there are some who think, well, this final battle that is described in the book of Revelation, this is going to take place in the city of Megiddo. So much so that our guide this last trip, who was very good, he's an Israeli, been doing this for almost 30 years, but he's very good at giving me or anyone he's working with opportunity to speak at every site. And he had kind of done his spiel about Megiddo, and then he leans over to me and he says, "You want to talk to them about how Armageddon's going to take place here?" And I said, "I don't believe Armageddon's going to take place here." And he said, "You're the first Christian preacher, minister, whatever I've ever heard to say that." Well, I don't believe that's true, but I believe that the reason why Armageddon, coming from the name Megiddo, was used was metaphorical. Not saying that the final battle between good and evil is going to take place on this mound that used to be the city in the nation of Israel. Because this city was a war zone. I mean, this was on the Via Maris. It was in the middle of this important trade route. It was constantly the site of conflict. I think it is used metaphorically in the book of Revelation to describe the final conflict by using this place that was a known place of conflict. Does that make sense? I don't actually think Armageddon is going to take place there on that little mound there, you know, near the Valley of Jezreel, okay? So, but there is a tie. When you walk into the site at Megiddo, the first sign, after you see the marker that says it's a national park, and after you see the first marker that says it's a national park, The next sign you see says Megiddo, like equals Armageddon, and is the whole description about how this is going to be the site of the final battle. I don't think that's, again, what John was intending, but using this again, there's so much imagery in the book of Revelation. I think this is a metaphor because it is using a place that was a site of conflict in describing this final spiritual battle. Just for those of you that were maybe not here in the first two lessons, and just as a recap for everyone else, Megiddo is a tell. A tell just simply means an artificial hill, okay? It looks from a distance, it looks like a hill. It is a hill, but it's not natural. The reason why the hill is there is because of the ancient way of when a city or civilization was destroyed, you rebuilt in the same place. And so over time, there wasn't an effort to, hey, if the city's destroyed, let's dig it all back out, back to the same level and start over. No, let's build back on top of the old one. And that kept happening. And when it happens 30 times, you end up with a hill, okay? And this illustration shows that when that happens, this one particular one has six layers. And in this illustration, each one of these represents a different historical age, the oldest being on the bottom, okay? And the challenge that creates from an archaeological standpoint is that if I want to get to layer six, what do I have to do? I have to dig through layers 1 through 5, which means inevitably I'm destroying something, right? So archaeology is not that any of us didn't think it was challenging, but maybe it's challenging for reasons that we've never conceived of. Because in order to get to one thing, I have to destroy something else, okay? And I'm going to show you an example of that in Megiddo and what they did about it. Just to me, it's very fascinating. This is the tell at Megiddo. It's not quite as distorted looking as this. I took it with a wide-angle lens so I could get the whole thing in one picture. But this is the tell, the mound. And this is a little kind of hiking path that goes up beside it, kind of does like a pinwheel into the middle, kind of circles up into the middle of this mound, this giant archaeological mound, this tell. And one of the first things that you see when you're going up the path is this ancient staircase. Now I want to mention, if this city is 5,000 years old, okay, that's pre-Israelite time. Now we know it had to have been in existence before the Israelites came in, because why? That it's mentioned in Joshua 12 as being conquered by the Israelites. So that means that prior to the conquering by the Israelites, it was controlled by one of the people that we identify as the quote Canaanites. Okay? And so when you're thinking about the archaeological findings in Megiddo, they're usually put in one of two buckets. This is Canaanite or this is Israelite. Okay. Now, we don't know exactly when the conquest, when Joshua took the children of Israel into Palestine and conquered. We don't know exactly when that happened. Best estimate is that was 15th century B.C. Let me say it another way. That's 1,500 years before the time of Christ. Okay. So if we're talking about something from the Canaanite period, that means it's pre-15th century. If we're talking about something Israelite period, that's post-15th century B.C. Okay? So, if it's Canaanite period, it is at least 3,500 years old. Okay? Say we're roughly 2,000 years since the time of Jesus. You go back another 1,500 years, we're 3,500 years before the time of Jesus. This staircase, which is fairly low into the side of this tell, this is a staircase from the Canaanite period. Now, this is pretty well intact. And this, again, this is estimated to be from the 15th century, so this is a 3,500-year-old staircase from the time of when the Canaanites were in control of Megiddo, prior to the Israelites coming in and conquering Megiddo. Now, as you go further up the hill, the first significant thing you come to is this gate. You may look at it and go, that doesn't look like a gate. Well, I've kind of taken the picture from a side angle, but you can see the path that goes between these two kind of rock walls, and there's this path that goes between them. This is the gate. This was the main gate to the city in the Canaanite period. Now, this is dated to 16th century BC, so, you know, 100 years roughly before the conquering by Israel. So this is a 3,600-year-old gate, and this was the main gate to the city of Megiddo. As you look in closer, on the side of the gate, there are these cutouts, which would have been rooms. So like maybe this is where the folks that collected taxes for you to come into a city would sit and collect taxes as you would come in and out of the city. But the reason why I zoomed in on this is I wanted you to see, you notice this line of kind of wood plank that's between the stone, the lower and the upper stones? What that plank is indicates what has been rebuilt and what has not. Okay, so what is below the wood plank is exactly as they found it. And what is above the plank was reassembled with stones that were around it. Now, again, that's a controversial thing in these archaeological sites, is there are plenty who are staunchly saying we should never rebuild any of this, even if it's with original stones. And there are others that say, well, if we're using original stones, we're showing people what this looked like using the original stones. Again, there's just kind of two schools of thought of this, but using stones that they found around the original stones that had not been rebuilt, they stacked them back up on top of each other. And so that's what that means. Now, I mentioned 16th century BC, 1600 years before the time of Jesus. If you go further up the hill, so this was kind of gratuitous to put a picture of my girls in here, but also, to kind of show you, kind of once you kind of come around the corner through the gate, you're looking up into the kind of the excavated part of this hill, and you can see looking up this path, there's all these layers of stone as you go through here, and that kind of just gives you a sense of the strata that have been excavated going up the hill. Now, as you go up the hill, directly up the hill from the Canaanite Gate, which is 16th century BC, is a gate. You may go, that doesn't look like a gate. That looks way less like a gate than the one before, for good reason. This gate is dated to 10th century BC. Okay? So 600 years later. 10th century would have been roughly the time of Solomon. So you know Solomon mentioned that Solomon fortified Megiddo. Perhaps it was during that fortification that this gate was built. This gate has been significantly destroyed. But the reason why it was destroyed was because it was destroyed to get to the 16th century gate below it. You with me? So a gate from the time of Solomon destroyed to get to a gate to the time from the time of the Canaanites. Okay. Now, you'll notice, though, that there's some little, you see these wood planks in here? What they're doing is they're already starting to rebuild it. Now, this was taken in December 2019. This is from the exact same angle in June of 22, okay? Right there. That's what it looks like now. So the gate that they partially destroyed to get to the one below it, they then took the rocks and put them back together and rebuilt it. And so it, you know, looks much more like a gate today than it did 2.5 years ago. So again, controversial, but nonetheless something that happens in a lot of places in Israel. Now, this is kind of from the very, very top of the site in Megiddo. And I took this picture to show, again, an example of the strata. You, each one of these, you know, we say like a layer of rock. Each one of these is a different strata. There is some of them, in some cases, they're very, very thin before you get from, you know, hundreds of years in difference. If you'll notice kind of in the bottom of this big hole where they've been excavating, there is this round circle of stones. That is an altar from the Canaanite period. So presumably where they would have had sacrifices from pre-Israelite time back to the Canaanite period. Now, up higher than that, this is from Israelite time. This is the remain. Now, this has not been rebuilt. This is kind of, you can see the footings here. But this is the remains of kind of this gigantic complex, which would have been both palace and stable. There's arguments in the archaeological community about when this should be dated to, but almost universal agreement that this is Israelite period. So the argument is this 10th century or 9th century? If it was 10th century, That's time of Solomon. We could be looking at a palace that Solomon built in Megiddo. If it's 9th century, it would have been another Israelite king, maybe somebody like Ahab. Okay? So we don't know, but mention again, we're talking three plus thousand years old. That's why this stuff is not nearly as intact as what we saw a couple weeks ago in Caesarea. Okay? But again, you can see the footing of the outline. And incidentally, you notice this little peak off in the distance here? Very shadowed, very light there. That's Mount Carmel, you know, where Elijah had his showdown with the prophets of Baal. So essentially, Megiddo is in the foothills of Mount Carmel, but Mount Carmel off in the distance, and that mountain is right on the Mediterranean. This was actually I put this up there because this is right when he had said, "Hey, you want to talk to them about how this is going to be where Armageddon's going to be?" And I said, "No, let me talk to them about how this is where Josiah died." But this is taken from the very tip top of Megiddo overlooking the Jezreel Valley. And so we talked about the Jezreel Valley a couple weeks ago. Just over my left-hand shoulder, you've got Mount Tabor. Up here, to my right here, you've got the city of Nazareth. And then far off to the right is Mount Gilboa, which I don't have in the picture. But just wanted to show you how Megiddo is right on the edge of the Valley of Jezreel. Now, on the other, so everything I've shown you so far was on the northern end of Megiddo. Okay, now we've moved to the southern end of Megiddo. And on the southern end of Megiddo, these are things that are a little newer, relatively speaking, than what's on the northern end. This is a grain silo. Again, I took it with a wide-angle lens, so it looks a little distorted. But this is a big hole in the ground, made with rocks, and you can see the ancient staircase. Everybody see that? The ancient staircase that goes down into this grain silo. Now, this is dated to 8th century BC, still time of the Israelites. If you look at the sign there at the site, it says this was the grain silo of Jeroboam II. I mean, they don't know whose grain silo it was, but 8th century, Jeroboam II would have lived roughly during the 8th century. But 8th century, so a little newer, a little more recent than the other ones. Further down the site, this is back up to the 9th century. This is a stable. I just showed you a stable, the remains of a stable on the northern end. This is a stable on the southern end. Little more intact. You may look at it and go, that doesn't look like a stable, but they've actually helpfully put a little horse outline there. So you can kind of see, you know, how that worked. So kind of cool. Now, my favorite thing at Megiddo is the water system. I had hoped to have a video to show you guys tonight of this, but the computer was absolutely melting down. I was trying to play the video. So if you want to see the video, I'd be happy to show it to you after service on my iPad. But I've got some pictures and I'll talk you through it. So even probably during the Israelite period, this was already a tell. You with me? Because this city had already existed for approximately 5,000 years, or at the time the Israelite period began, 3,500 years. It was already a tell. It was already a mound. Okay? And one of the things you see in a lot of these cities that are tells is you will see very, very sophisticated water systems, okay? And what does that mean? Well, they did not have quite like what we have today, like, pipes and indoor plumbing and all that kind of stuff that would deliver them directly to their homes. They got their water from where? A spring or a river or some places they had like aqueducts, like we saw in Caesarea, where they brought the water in. But they had to have a source of water in order to exist. Right? I mean, we understand that. You have to have water to live. Well, in Megiddo, like a lot of these places, the spring was outside of the hill. Okay? So in order for them to get water, they would go down the hill to the spring, collect water, bring it up to the top of the hill. But this proved a great vulnerability against attacking armies. Because if an attacking army laid siege on a city built upon a hill whose water source was outside the hill, what could they do? they could cut off their water supply, right? Does that make sense? So if an army lays siege, meaning they just, they're not attacking, they're just surrounding, they can cut them off from getting access to their water. Now, this, the water system at Megiddo is dated to the 9th century. Now, this is, again, we don't know exactly who built this, but that would have been the time of Ahab, okay? But the way this works is, what they did was up on top of the tell, you had the city, you know, the city walls up on top of the tell, and inside the city walls, they dug a shaft all the way down to ground level, okay? Or actually even below ground level, to below ground level. And then from that shaft, they dug a tunnel to the spring. Then they cut off access to the spring from the outside. They covered it so that the invading army could not get to the spring. And therefore, those that were still in the city could get to the spring by going down the shaft, going through the tunnel, getting water from the spring, and then coming back up into the city. So if their city was surrounded by an invading army, they still had access to their water, okay? And the cool thing is, even though this is, you know, 3,000 years old, you can still go through. And so this is the top of where the shaft was dug. Now, obviously, these are modern-day steps that have been built to go down into the shaft. But I want you to notice, you see over here on the right, you see these rocks right here? That's the ancient staircase that they would have used to get down into the shaft. So you see what just looks like a pile of rocks. Those are actually stairs going down into the shaft. And as you go down in here, they've got, again, modern-day steps that have been built to go down. But you can see where they cut into the rock, you know, this shaft going down, you know, below ground level. And the further you go down, this is the final kind of few steps down the shaft into this tunnel, okay? And this tunnel, I don't know how long the tunnel is, probably a couple hundred yards, a couple of football fields long. And then when you get to the end, but you notice how this is just cut directly out of the rock. And you think, this is 3,000 years old. Incredible what they were able to do 3,000 years ago. But you go all the way to the end, and guess what's still there? Water. The spring is still there. It's actually, the actual spring is directly behind this wall, but the water sinks in just to the end of this tunnel. Now, fortunately, I don't have a picture there, but fortunately they have reopened what was previously covered, and you can walk up the steps and go right out right there. But so neat. Now, again, I've got a video of us going through it. It's only a minute long, if not the whole thing. But if you want to watch that, I'd be happy to show it to you later. But that's Megiddo, okay? Now, I'm going to move from there to a site that I'm going to try to cover fairly quickly, because this is a biblical site, but its significance to the Bible is not really what it's known for, or at least what we know from the Bible is not what it's known for. And this is Mount Tabor. Mount Tabor is a biblical site mentioned numerous times in the Old Testament, but Mount Tabor is more known as being the traditional site. Do you hear what I said? Traditional site of the transfiguration of Jesus. We do not know where the transfiguration took place. And at least on this side of eternity, we will never know. Because all we know is it says they went up into a high mountain. We don't know. But this is the traditional site where the transfiguration took place. Now, before we talk about the transfiguration, though, I just want to point out, we were just talking about Megiddo. Okay, so now we are going across the Valley of Jezreel to the northeast side of the Valley of Jezreel to Mount Tabor. Okay, and Tabor, as I just mentioned, northeast side of the Jezreel Valley, even though it is known as a mountain, it's only 1,800 feet tall. So just looking at it from ground level, it doesn't really look like a mountain. It just looks like a hill. We think of mountains, we think about the Smoky Mountains. It does not look like that, okay? It doesn't look like that. It's fairly small. But it's mentioned 11 times in the Old Testament. What I consider the most significant things, Deborah, it mentions in Judges that Deborah and Barak, met on Mount Tabor in Judges 4. Tabor is mentioned by conversation between Gideon and two men. He's captured in Judges chapter 8, but not a significant place in the Old Testament. Though it, again, mentioned a few times, but not significant. What do we know it for? We know it, we know it because it is the traditional site of the Transfiguration. All we know from, like, for example, from Matthew 17, is that they went up into a high mountain. There is a lot of debate about whether, you know, could this have been instead Mount Hermon? Mount Hermon, which is over 9,000 feet tall, that really is a mountain. But then that's its own challenges. Did they really climb a 9,000-foot tall mountain for Jesus to be trained? We don't know. We don't know where it took place, okay? But this is the traditional site of the Transfiguration, all right? I'm going to skip through this. But this is Mount Tabor. Again, doesn't really look like a mountain. It's just more like a hill. Going up Mount Tabor, you can see the Valley of Jezreel coming in below. This is the city of Nazareth. Probably next time that we do one of these lessons, I'll talk about Nazareth. There's not a ton to talk about with Nazareth. There's not much archaeology there today. But we'll talk a little bit about Nazareth. But Valley of Jezreel laid out below, kind of Mount Tabor. This is Mount Gilboa. Anybody remember what happened on Mount Gilboa? It's where King Saul and Jonathan were killed on Mount Gilboa. So again, relatively near to Mount Tabor. I put this picture in there just to make a note that if any of you guys ever go to Israel with me or go with someone else, one thing you're going to see is that Israel is full of cats, feral cats, okay? They are everywhere. The gentleman that was my co-leader on this last trip, this was his eighth trip, is that right, or seventh trip? I lose track. Anyway, he told me, Tim, I have never seen a cat when I've been to Israel. And I said, Bruce, they're everywhere. And we had barely even gotten off the plane this time. There was a cat in the airport. They're everywhere, okay? They're everywhere. And I was recently talking with someone who, this was taken in December of 2019. I was talking to somebody that went with me on that trip, and he said, I was trying to get in the headspace for maybe this is where Jesus was transfigured, and all I could think of, why are there so many cats up on top of Mount Tabor? There's cats everywhere. Now, I'm going to say this a lot as we go through a lot of these sites, but how do we know if we're in Israel if a site is a traditional site where something occurred? There is a church building there. Okay? If you see a church building, at least an ornate one, more than likely this is a traditional site of something. Okay? Someone believes something happened here and the Franciscans built a church there. Okay? That's the case with Mount Tabor. This is the Church of the Transfiguration, of course. It was built in 1924. So relatively new church building, but was built up on top of the remains of many previous buildings that were built all the way back to the Byzantine period, 4th to 6th century AD. So this has been identified as a traditional site of the Transfiguration since the 5th century. And they just keep rebuilding these buildings back on top of it. So many of the church buildings that are in Israel in traditional sites were built and controlled by the Franciscans. The Franciscans are a religious group that date back to the 12th century, started by St. Francis of Assisi, Franciscan, St. Francis. And they're made up of many different religious groups, but primarily Catholic, okay? So this is a Catholic, it's a Franciscan church, but it's a Catholic church building. Now, one thing you will notice is that it has three peaks on the roof. Why is that? Because they're representing Jesus, Moses, and Elijah. Traditional site of the Transfiguration. We'll talk more about that in just a minute. We'll talk about it right now. Does anybody, you remember when the Transfiguration happened? What did Peter want to do? Let's build three tents, three tabernacles to commemorate. And I don't necessarily say that Jesus rebuked him. Jesus didn't even acknowledge it, right? God started speaking, and Jesus never even acknowledged it. So clearly it didn't happen. But that's what Peter suggested. And in 1924, the Franciscans thought, hey, that was a great idea. Let's do the same. Let's do what Peter said. I just find that fascinating that this whole thing was about Jesus. And Peter was missing it. And 2,000 years later, we're still missing it. We still were, hey, let's build these tabernacles like Peter suggested, which is essentially what happened. And so the middle sanctuary is dedicated to Jesus. This is the Jesus tabernacle, if you will. You have Jesus there in the middle. You have Moses on the left. You have Elijah on the right. And I can't remember which of these, you know, Peter, James, and John, which ones are supposed to be which, but it doesn't really matter. But then on the left tabernacle, you have Moses. Right tabernacle, you have Elijah. And so they have now done what Peter wanted to do back, you know, back when they were actually up on the mountain, okay? One thing I wanted to point out, this symbol is all over the nation of Israel today. And this is actually the symbol of the Franciscan order. But that is not what people know of it as today. This is referred to today as the Jerusalem cross. Again, it started off as the symbol of the Franciscans, but it is known today as the Jerusalem cross, and there you can buy this emblem on anything. I mean, you know, necklaces and jewelry and purses and wallets, and you know, I'm sure you can get tattoos or whatever you want that's got the Jerusalem cross on it. And people will say, well, this is, you know, commemorating the Great Commission where Jesus was telling them to go out, and this is commemorating Jerusalem and then the four corners of the world where he sent the disciples out. Some will say this represents the five wounds of Jesus, his hands, his feet, and his side. It started off as a Franciscan symbol, but it, again, today it is considered kind of the de facto symbol of the Holy Lands. And so if you ever see someone with jewelry where they've got this, you know, all of my girls have various jewelry that has this symbol in it. I have cufflinks that have this symbol on it. This is considered to be the de facto symbol of the Holy Lands. All right, last place I'm going to mention, I'm going to do this one quickly. Talk about Hazor. Who remembers Hazor from Joshua 11? Anybody? Anybody? All right, Hazor, Joshua 11. So Hazor is another one of those places that's mentioned within the conquest by the Joshua-led children of Israel on. Hazor. So we've just been talking about, so here's Megiddo, Jezreel Valley, Mount Gilboa. Mount Tabor is not on here, but this is the Jezreel Valley. Now we are moving up into kind of right on the edge between the Lower Galilee and Upper Galilee, and there's the city of Hazor. And Hazor just north of the Sea of Galilee, in this little tiny body of water is Lake Hula, and This area is known locally, most people don't talk about this, but it's the Valley of Hula, which is where Hazor is located. Hazor is a tale, we've already talked about a tale, I won't go through this again. Hazor is a tale. You find things, the excavations in Hazor have uncovered things from the Canaanite period and the Israelite period. And mentioned Valley of Hula. First documentation about Hazor comes from 19th century BC, so we're talking 4,000 years ago. This was a very, I'll mention this later, this was a big city for those times. They estimate that Hazor could have been as big as 20,000 people in its heyday. If you remember in Joshua 11, it kind of talks about, you know, Hazor among those other cities where all the kings came out and the armies met together, and how Hazor is kind of mentioned as like, this was a significant city. And then after Israelites had defeated all the Canaanite kings, they went back and they burned Hazor to the ground. Hazor was a significant city, okay? Probably much, much larger than Megiddo, and again, in its peak. This was a very, very large city. Just talked about Joshua 11, Jabin, king of Hazor, along with some other Canaanite cities. They met Joshua. The Israelite army defeated the Canaanite army. They went back and they burned Hazor. Hazor is going to pop up again in Judges 4, and also is the name Jabin. You go, well, how could that be? If Jabin was killed back in Joshua 11, how can you have Jabin in Judges 4? Well, it's very possible that Jabin was more of a dynastic name, like Pharaoh or Caesar, than an individual's personal name. And so therefore it would have not been uncommon to have that name repeat itself. So don't let that trip you up. And we talked about the Megiddo. The Megiddo was one of those cities that Solomon specifically mentions in 1 Kings that Solomon fortified. Hazor is another one of those cities that Solomon fortified. So when Solomon is building up the defenses in the army of Israel, Hazor is one of those that was included in that list in 1 Kings 9. The last historical reference to Hazor is in 2 Kings when Hazor was one of the cities that fell to Assyria. Again, Hazor by that time was part of the northern kingdom and fell to Assyria, 732 B.C. So that's kind of the last reference to Hazor. Now, this is taken from the top of the Tell at Hazor. You can see some of the stones there in the foreground. This is the Valley of Hela looking north. And just past these mountains is the country of Lebanon today. So not too far from Lebanon. This is a gate to the city. And this is referred to as Solomon's Gate because this gate was identified or dated to the 10th century B.C. And again, because this is one of the cities that was listed as being fortified by Solomon, they identify this gate with Solomon. But 10th century clearly would have been during the time of, you know, the United Kingdom under the monarchs of Israel. You know, so David, Solomon during that time. But this is, you know, a gate going into the city. So this is clearly Israelite time period. As you move into the site, kind of down a little bit, this, it's hard to see this. I don't have a great picture of this. And I wasn't able to update any of these. We didn't go to Hazor on this last trip because we missed the day, and so we had to decide what we're going to keep them or not. But under this giant metal covering is a temple from the Canaanite period. This is a little closer. And again, it's super dark on this screen, so this is not going to be terribly helpful. But this would have been, again, this is pre-15th century B.C., a temple from the time of the Canaanites. So something that would have been destroyed by, you know, the Israelite army when they came back and destroyed Hazor. And then this, you might want to guess what that is. Well, we just talked about it, Megiddo. That's the water system. Yeah, the water system at Hazor works a very similar way. I did not get to go down in that one, so I don't have any pictures or video from down inside of that one. But very similar concept. You know, again, going down, getting to the water source, be able to come back out. Now, this, I got two slides left, and then I'm going to end. This is, you know, in the foreground, what you have is a citadel, the remains of a citadel, a stronghold. It's dated to the 10th century B.C., so again, that's like time of Solomon. And then in the background, you have a tower that is dated to the 9th century B.C. And I just want to show just that little change in elevation. You know, we're talking about 100 years difference. Hey, one was built, then the next one was built later up on top. And so, again, this would have been roughly time of Solomon. This, you know, again, one of the kings in the 9th century was likely Ahab. And then the final thing I was going to show you, and this is not specific to Hazor, unique to Hazor, but this is an olive press. Olive oil, olive trees, anything olive it's a huge industry even to today in Israel, anything olive. And this is a 8th century B.C. olive press where they would have pressed olive oil. So you can, you know, this is 800 years before the time of Jesus. You can read about olive oil in the time of Jesus. You can read about olive oil after the time of Jesus. And there's olive oil everywhere you look in Israel today. All right, that's the last slide. And we'll have our invitation song in just a second. But, you know, one of the things that clearly we talked about Megiddo and Hazor, which helps us in thinking through some of the things we've been studying in the book of Joshua for Bible World, right? Where, you know, the children of Israel have been given a promise. They, you know, the spies, all of them but two, doubted, right? And because of their doubting, what did they have to do? They had to wander for 40 years. And we learned tonight that from the time of Caleb going in until the time of Caleb getting Hebron was 45 years. So 40 years, then I guess that means all this took place in 5 years, what we've been reading so far in Joshua, right? But for 40 years, they didn't get what they were promised because they doubted. But God fulfilled his promise. And when they trusted in him, he gave them what he said. And when they let go of him like an Ai, when they didn't trust him, or they didn't do what he said in Jericho, and so they lost the first battle in Ai. But when they trusted him, he fulfilled his promises. He gave them Megiddo. He gave them Hazor, even though it was a 20,000 people, this huge prominent city. He gave them Hazor because he had promised it, and they were faithful. And thinking back to our lesson this morning, where Jesus says, my Father's house has enough room for you. I'm going to prepare a place. If it wasn't so, I wouldn't tell you that I was going to prepare a place. Trust in me. And God has demonstrated throughout his revealed word that he is always faithful to his promises. And just like he gave the land into their hands as he promised Abraham, a long time before that, that he would, he's going to be faithful to the promise that he will give us a home for all eternity if we trust in his son, if we believe in his son. But he leaves it to us to make the choice of whether we're going to do that or not. So we have to make that choice. Are we going to not follow him like the people did when they didn't utterly decimate everything in Jericho and they lost the first battle in Ai? Or are we going to follow him the way he has asked us to follow him? We have a choice. And if you're here tonight and you've never made that choice, I encourage you to think about making that choice to being baptized and being ready to live a life of Christ. If you're here tonight and you need anything else, please come while we sing our invitation song.